some procedural we will note that Justice Pickering is in Las Vegas with us today. I want to caution you all, there can be some slight delay in the transmission between here and Las Vegas, and so if you are either talking to Justice Pickering or if she's asking a question, be sure that you just pause for a second so that you can allow that transmission to take place. And I would note that we have not installed what appears to be a couch on the bench in Las Vegas. Poor Justice Pickering was actually ousted from the courtroom down there because we are running out of space to handle all the business of the court with the new Court of Appeals. And so she has taken one for the team, and she is working from a conference room this afternoon. So we appreciate that accommodation. And with that, we'll go ahead and get started. Next case on our agenda is case number 65453, Acerium Corporation versus Hovers. Mr. Gunther, are you prepared to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, I'm Anthony Gunther, and I'm representing the appellants in this matter. The primary appellant, Asia Rim, is the pronunciation, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Asia Rim Corporation is a publicly traded company here in the United States, incorporated in Nevada in 2007, and at least until the events leading up to the lawsuit that we're on appeal from, maintained registered agent in the state of Nevada. Prior to that time frame, Asia Rim held certain rights relating to the Commodore brand from the Commodore 64 computers and those types of products from decades ago, and they held those rights through various subsidiary and sub-subsidiary companies. Asia Rim Corporation is the holding company of those. And those rights that they owned, having to do with the brand, I, for convenience sake, just refer to them as Commodore brand rights or Asia Rim's intellectual property rights. And those rights were Asia Rim's sole source of revenue, its only assets from which all of its revenues were derived. And those were taken away. And in February of 2013, we filed a complaint in Clark County that we amended a couple weeks later to fix some mistakes, alleging, among other things, that the respondents, Eben and Hugstrata, who were secured creditors of Asia Rim in connection with their acquiring of those Commodore brand rights, those two, together with the two new officers of Asia Rim, which are respondents Hovers and Van Oss, that the four of them conspired together and did wrongfully fraudulently transfer those Commodore brand rights from Asia Rim, the dealings were with Asia Rim, to respondents Eben and Hoogstrata, and that they did that without notifying or getting the consent from Asia Rim shareholders as required by the Nevada Articles of Incorporation on file with the Nevada Secretary of State, and Nevada law on the rights and responsibilities of officers and directors. We contend that Hovers and Van Oss, the officers, breached their fiduciary duties to the corporation, and we contend that the other two, Eben and Hoogstrata, conspired with Hovers and Van Oss and instigated and orchestrated this scheme by which they would acquire these rights from Asia Rim. And then, of course, the respondents filed a motion to dismiss, or motions to dismiss, which the district court granted, resulting in our appeal. And as far as the arguments go, the seems like logically and conveniently, the two officers fit in one category and the two non-officers fit in another category. And to start, I would like to address the two officers, Hovers and Van Oss, primarily because the situation relative to those two seems to be identical or virtually identical to the situation before this court in the Concipio Holding BV v. Carlberg matter. You have officers of a Nevada corporation who owed fiduciary duties, who are accused of breaching those fiduciary duties and causing harm to the Nevada corporation. The district court below indeed found that we adequately alleged that respondents Hovers and Vanoss, as officers of Asia Rim, caused direct injury to the corporation, and the district court found that that was sufficient to establish the first and second prongs of the three-part specific personal jurisdiction test that is set forth in Concipio as well as other cases from this court. And we think on that basis, and quoting from Concipio, the burden of producing evidence that establishes a prima facie showing of jurisdiction was met in Concipio by establishing those first two factors. We've established those first two factors, and we think we've therefore established a prima facie case for the reasonable exercise of personal jurisdiction over the two officers, Hovers and Vanoss.
Mr. Gunther, as part of that case analysis you're doing, could you comment on the case of Walden versus Fiore, 134 Supreme Court, 1115, which I think was subsequent to Concipio, just how that may play into this equation here?
Yes, the Walden opinion involves the officer from Georgia who specifically targeted someone, but it wasn't without, it was entirely without regard to where they lived, what forum they might be going to. I believe in the facts, it wasn't even clear whether they were from Nevada or from California and had only showed California ID. And I believe the Supreme Court correctly decided that you couldn't found jurisdiction on where targeted individuals might decide to go after they've been targeted. Or where they might decide. It was done, there was no relationship to Nevada in what the defendant was doing in that case. He wasn't directing harm into any particular forum because he didn't really know where they were from. Whereas in this case, and in the case law like the Bancroft decision, which wasn't, it was overruled by Yahoo on other grounds, but the portion that says that you can specifically, you know, where someone specifically directs tortious conduct at a forum resident, that they've established the purposeful direction, which is a side-by-side with purposeful availment, that it's distinguished because in this case you had Eben and Hoogstrada, as well as Hovers and Vanoss, that specifically targeted a Nevada corporation. And under the precedents from the Supreme Court, from Haston to Bancroft in the Ninth Circuit, those all still look to me like good law because there is a distinction between somebody that you target without regard to where they might live or anything like that and those people that you specifically target in Nevada to breach your fiduciary duties of the corporation. But otherwise, I think in terms of Vanoss and Hovers, the directors or the officers, they did establish the first two elements. I mean, the district court found that the first two elements of the three-prong test were met. So I have presumptively reasonable exercise of personal jurisdiction, and under this court's jurisprudence, I'm quoting here from Firouzabadi, 110 Nevada, 1348 from 1994, whereas here the jurisdictional issue is decided without a full evidentiary hearing, the plaintiff need only make a prima facie showing of jurisdiction. And so if I've made a prima facie jurisdiction by establishing the first two elements, then what comes next is an evidentiary hearing if we're going to overturn that presumptively reasonable jurisdiction on reasonableness grounds, and that we didn't have here. And for that reason, we think that the district court erred in dismissing on a lack of personal jurisdiction. If the court wants to, just as in Concipio, do a further analysis on the facts and the reasonableness factors, conduct an evidentiary hearing on that, we would be, you know, and then come to the decision to dismiss, I think that would be more procedurally proper. Moving on then to the other two, respondents Eben and Hoogstrada, the district court did not decide whether or not we had met the first two factors of the three-prong test. What the district court decided was that even if the court decided we met that test, the reasonableness analysis conducted by the court dictated that the exercise of jurisdiction would be unreasonable in this case, and decided that for both sets of defendants. But we didn't get we had the first element found by the district court on the officers. The district court didn't decide whether we met that prima facie showing with respect to the other two.
May I just interrupt for a moment? I apologize. Justice Pickering, I want to be sure that your audio and video is okay down there.
It's fine. Thank you so much.
Please proceed.
The dismissal order suggests that that we relied only on the allegations that harm was caused to a Nevada citizen in trying to establish those first two prongs. But it's our position, our briefs are pretty clear. We allege that the Eben and Hoogstrada engaged in the same wrongful conduct that the officers engaged in. They all conspired together. They all specifically targeted Asia Rim. They all knew very well that Asia Rim was a Nevada corporation. Eben and Hoogstrada, and it's not like they were at the hub of this conspiracy, not out at a spoke. They were the instigators and the orchestrators of this alleged conspiracy, or the alleged orchestrators and of the alleged conspiracy. Eben, as we put in our paper, secretly funded this URAM deal and the dealings that on which proceeding with this $28 million deal with URAM that nobody knew Eben was funding, right, required that they change their officers and directors. It required that they change their principal registered offices for filings with the United States Security and Exchange Commission from Hong Kong to Reno, Nevada, which happened. And then they went through and carried out this taking of the Commodore brand rights from Asia Rim. And so we don't think that we have random, attenuated, fortuitous types of contacts here by Eben and Hoogstrada. They directed through Hovers and Van Oss to reach into Nevada, change the offices for SEC filings, go forward with breaching your fiduciary duties. You probably didn't say it in those terms, but, you know, go forward intentionally doing what you shouldn't be doing under Nevada law in terms of, you know, not notifying your shareholders as you're required before you dispose of all the assets of a company.
Sir, I want to caution you. I don't know that you reserved any time for rebuttal, but you have 3 minutes and 45 seconds remaining.
Yes, and that was basically where I was. I think the case law on wrongful conduct directed against a plaintiff whom the defendant knows to be a resident of the foreign state, that is still good law, as far as I can tell, notwithstanding being told in the briefs that that's been overruled. And I think we have that here. It's not random, attenuated, fortuitous. They were specifically picking out Asia Rim, which they specifically knew was a Nevada corporation. They took acts conspiratorially or otherwise in furtherance of that. And with that, I'll pass the argument.
Thank you, Mr. Gunther. Mr. Tenner.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Dan Hayward on behalf of Respondents Hovers.
My apologies, Mr. Hayward.
May it please the Court and Counsel and ladies and gentlemen. I'm here, of course, on behalf of Johannes Conradus Maria Hovers, who is a Dutch resident and also a citizen of the Netherlands. He was a director and president and CEO of the plaintiff Asia Rim from July 23rd of 2011 until later that year on October 31st, 2011. My other client on behalf of whom I'm here today is Mr. Van Oss, Eugene Van Oss, who is a Dutch citizen as well and a resident of Germany. He was not a director, but was an officer of Asia Rim from the July 30th to October 31st, 2011 time period. Now, before I won't get into the merits of the case because they're not particularly important for what we're here to do today, which is to look at personal jurisdiction issues. But before I do go over a very basic background, I'd like to refresh the Court's recollection about who's who in areas of incorporation. One of the names you'll hear is Reunite Investments, Inc., a Colorado company, which is the parent of Asia Rim, the Nevada plaintiff. Asia Rim is in turn the parent of Asia Rim UK Limited, which, as the name suggests, is a British company. Asia Rim UK Limited is in turn the parent of Commodore Licensing BV, a Dutch company, which is in turn the parent of and was the sole shareholder of C Equals Holdings BV, another Dutch company.
Asia Rim Corporation, a Nevada corporation, is a publicly traded company. What exchange is it traded on?
I believe it's on the New York Stock Exchange. Okay. I hope I'm not misspeaking. I don't have a firm knowledge of that. That would be discussed, I'm sure, in the transcript of the Southern District of New York case that's attached to the appendix. Between 2009 and 2010, co-respondents Evan and Hoogstrada loaned approximately 800,000 euros to Reunite and Asia Rim so that Reunite could purchase 100% of the shares of C Equals Holdings, the Dutch company. As security, Evan and Hoogstrada eventually, prior to my client's involvement as officers and directors, secured a pledge on 100% of those shares of C Equals Holdings. Now, Reunite then transferred the shares of C Equals Holdings to Commodore Licensing BV, which is Asia Rim's subsidiary, a Dutch company. Now, following multiple payment defaults by Asia Rim and extensions of time by which to pay, Evans and Hoogstrada entered into an agreement with Asia Rim on September 20th of 2011, which is at the crux of this case. That is the core allegation of the plaintiff's amended complaint. And my clients were at the helm of the company at the time that agreement was entered into. All shares were eventually transferred to Evans and Hoogstrada on November 7th, Your Honors, of 2011. Now, the district court, in evaluating personal jurisdiction, found that Asia Rim had satisfied the first two prongs of the three-part personal jurisdiction test, specific personal jurisdiction test, of purposeful availment and arising out of, if you will. Judge Gaddish, largely based that upon the Concipio decision and the fact that my clients were directors and officers of the company who are alleged to have directed harm at a Nevada company. However, the court also engaged, as Concipio requires at footnote 4, in an analysis of the third prong of the personal jurisdiction test, reasonableness. And the court did so in a non-evidentiary hearing, oral argument, however, with affidavits, declarations, what you might call discovery materials, ample discovery materials and ample briefing, and ultimately held that personal jurisdiction would be improper over my clients and the co-respondents. Now, I want to discuss the procedure by which
co-counsel here can comment. So are you splitting the time up?
We are. They will reserve 5 minutes.
So I will try and be brief here, but Mr. Gunther is suggesting that this should be explored more through an evidentiary hearing, the additional prongs here. Tell us why you believe that this process of doing it on declarations and affidavits was sufficient and does not require an evidentiary hearing.
Very good, Your Honor. Mr. Gunther is correct that at the motion stage, when the defendants challenge personal jurisdiction, the plaintiff need only show a prima facie case of the first two elements of the three-part test and may do so in a non-evidentiary hearing context. However, as the Trump case tells us, the burden of proof ultimately never shifts to the defendants. And either at trial or in another pre-trial evidentiary hearing, the plaintiffs must eventually prove, without any inferences or benefits of inferences on the evidence, they must prove by preponderance of the evidence that personal jurisdiction is appropriate. Now, that's where the confusion about an evidentiary hearing requirement comes in. That evidentiary hearing, which must either be held before trial or in the trial itself, whereby the plaintiff proves personal jurisdiction by preponderance, merely is the second phase of what the plaintiff must ultimately do to prove its case. That does not mean that the defendant, the Trump case and others tell us that after those first two prongs have been met by a prima facie standard at the motion stage, that the defendant may still prove a compelling case of unreasonableness and thus defeat personal jurisdiction. Now, Your Honor, there is no requirement that that be done in the context of an evidentiary hearing. And in support, I would cite to you in Concipio, for example, this court sent the matter back down to the district court for, quote, further factual analysis, but there was no requirement of a evidentiary hearing. Presumably on its de novo review, the court just didn't find enough in the record to make the reasonableness analysis itself. In the Trump case, in the There is a body of cases, also Nevada cases, cited for the proposition that an evidentiary hearing is required by the plaintiffs. The Supreme Court actually engaged in the reasonableness analysis on appeal in its de novo review, and in those particular cases found that the exercise of personal jurisdiction could be reasonable, but they engaged in the analysis without the benefit of any apparent evidentiary hearing having been held below before the appeal. And the same is true in the Arbella case. Now, the most telling case, though, because we are talking about constitutional considerations and federal cases are pertinent, is perhaps the Amoco Egypt Oil Company case, where Amoco Egypt Oil Company sued because the defendant's ship went into its oil platform in the seas off of the coast of Egypt, and they brought suit in Washington. There was no evidentiary hearing below, and that's not just an assumption. The court expressly made that clear at 1F 3rd, page 850 of that opinion. But the Ninth Circuit, exercising de novo review, looked at the reasonableness factor, and it concluded the exercise of personal jurisdiction over that Egyptian company, or actually a Philippine company doing business in Egypt, was unreasonable and dismissed the case. No evidentiary hearing, de novo review, the court looked at it, looked at the reasonableness factor, found it unreasonable, and that was the end of it. There is no requirement, Your Honors, for an evidentiary hearing from here on out. The same is true in the Marina Salina Cruz case out of the Ninth Circuit, where personal jurisdiction was found not to exist in Alaska over a Mexican naval shipyard that allegedly caused some damage to caused a ship to sink as a result of some negligent modifications. On appeal, the court found, as part of its de novo review, that personal jurisdiction was not reasonable. So it is very much up to Your Honors. There's no requirement to send it back, as was done in Concepcion, for whatever reason, perhaps because the record was not complete. Now, Your Honors, I would touch on the Walden Fiore case briefly. I have about 2 minutes before I cede the rest of my time. Concepcion, of course, did not find, as a matter of law or fact, that personal jurisdiction existed over private media, which was the corporation at issue, the Nevada Corporation. It found the first two prongs were satisfied by virtue of the defendant's status as officers and directors and the allegations of directing harm at the Nevada company. Then it sent it back down for an evaluation of reasonableness, finding that that was mandated, that review of the third prong was mandated. Well, that mandated evaluation has occurred in this case with ample evidentiary support, ample analysis by the district court. And the court is rightly found by applying the five-prong test that the Nevada courts have employed to evaluate reasonableness, that it would be unreasonable to exercise jurisdiction over my client. Now, if that reasonableness prong is to mean anything at all, other than a sort of pro forma rubber stamp that we're looking at reasonableness, then this is the case where personal jurisdiction should not lie. Because it must mean something. It must require something more than just being a director and officer of a company. Or Your Honors would not have sent Concepcion back down for an analysis. There would have been no need. There has to be something more than that. And in this case, there is nothing more than that. The transaction at issue occurred in the Netherlands. The stock was of a Dutch company, owned by a Dutch company, owned by a British company, ultimately owned by a Nevada company. We allege that Dutch law would apply when you're talking about the transfer of the shares of a Dutch subsidiary. All the witnesses are in Europe or Asia. None are here. There's no evidence of any bank accounts here for Asia Rim. The only evidence of an office is the technical registered agent office for purposes of state law or the SEC. Simply put, this is the case where there is no additional fact besides the simple fact of my clients being a directors and officers of the company that supports jurisdiction. I would lastly just urge the court, the Ninth Circuit follows a seven-part test, not the five-part test used by the district court. The court is free to engage in, to consider whatever factors it wishes. The test is not rigid. And two of the additional factors I think the court should evaluate are the extent of personal interjection into the forum, which you can consider even where purposeful availment has been found as part of the first main prong. And I think it's the Coravent case of the Ninth Circuit that says that consideration is still appropriate even when you found the first prong exists. I think that's where Walden Fiore comes in, Your Honor. If you could overrule Concepcion, and probably without much effect, because now we have the 2013 acceptance of service of process statute that might sort of make that case obsolete in on a go-forward basis in future cases involving directors and officers, not this one because we predated that statute. But if you don't overrule it, I think you should consider Wallen-Fiore when evaluating the personal interjection aspect of the seven-part Ninth Circuit test. I'll cede the rest of my time to my colleague, Mr. Tennant, if I may.
Mr. Tennant, you have 3 minutes and 40 seconds, but I am going to give you another minute just to be sure that you have an ample opportunity to present your client's case, should you need it, and I will add 1 minute's time to Mr. Gunther as well.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon, Your Honors. I am John Tennant, and together with Alan Wilt from Fenimore Craig, we represent the respondents, Albertus Eben and Yang Hustrata. The district court's finding that Azarim failed to make a prima facie showing of specific personal jurisdiction as to Eben and Hoopstrato was correct. As this court knows, in tort cases, there must be a three-part test satisfied. There must first be a showing of purposeful conduct at the forum. Second, the claims must arise from that purposeful conduct. And third, the jurisdiction must be reasonable. The record below supports that this court may affirm the dismissal for lack of personal jurisdiction on any grounds, including as to Eben and Hoopstrato, including lack of minimum contacts and unreasonableness. Importantly here, the minimum contacts analysis as to Eben and Hoopstrato is distinct from that of Azarim's former officer and director, Mr. Van Oss and Mr. Hoberts. Concipio applies to the officers and directors of a Nevada company, and that addresses the minimum contacts. As to Eben and Hoopstrato, the 2014 Supreme Court case, Walden v. Fiore, governs. In Walden, the Supreme Court clarified and confirmed that activities directed to a plaintiff who happens to be a resident of the forum state is not in and of itself sufficient to establish jurisdiction, even if the defendant knows that that plaintiff is a resident of the forum state. Walden emphasizes, I'm quoting from Walden, it is the defendant, not the plaintiff or third parties, who must create the contacts with the forum state, and therefore focuses the minimum contacts analysis on the defendant's contacts with the forum state itself and not the plaintiff who happens to reside there. In short, the plaintiff cannot be the only link between the defendant and the forum. Here, Azarim's sole jurisdictional allegation as to Eben and Hoopstrato is that they caused harm to a Nevada corporation based on their activities abroad. That is insufficient under Walden. It is undisputed that no part of Eben and Hoopstrato's alleged tortious acts occurred in Nevada or even in the United States. All of the intentional acts that are alleged by Azarim in connection with this transfer occurred in the Netherlands. The contracts were negotiated and executed in the Netherlands, and significantly, the operative contracts contain a forum selection clause that places all claims that arise out of this transaction in the courts of Breda in the Netherlands. In Walden, the Supreme Court found that Georgia officers did not have sufficient contacts with the state of Nevada when they seized a large sum of cash from two Nevada residents traveling through the Atlanta airport. The Nevada residents argued there that that personal jurisdiction was proper in the state of Nevada, alleging that the officer knew that the plaintiffs were from Nevada and the harm would be felt there. The Supreme Court found that jurisdiction was not proper over the Georgia police officer, because there were no other contacts. The court said that you cannot look at solely the plaintiff's contacts with the forum state. Similar to the police officer in Walden, Eben and Hoopstrato's only contact with the state of Nevada is their dealings with Azarim, or their alleged knowledge that Azarim was a company incorporated in the state of Nevada. The U.S. Supreme Court's holding in Walden soundly forecloses this argument as a potential basis for personal jurisdiction in the state of Nevada. Given this total lack of contacts, minimum contacts, on this ground, in applying Walden, this court may affirm the district court's dismissal based on lack of personal jurisdiction for a finding of no minimum contacts. The district court below did not make a finding on minimum. It did address minimum contracts as the Eben and Hoopstrato in its order. It ultimately dismissed the case based on lack of reasonableness, which also provides this court a basis to affirm the lower court's holding. And as to the reasonableness factors, it was true where there's a showing of minimum contacts, then the defendant has to present a compelling case to show that exercising jurisdiction will be unreasonable. Here, as to Evan and Hoekstrada, there has been no showing of minimum contacts, which provides a basis for the court to dismiss the case. But even if the court were to look at the reasonableness factors, the Evan and Hoekstrada would not have to present a compelling case. The lack of minimum contacts, if Evan and Hoekstrada did have a burden to present a case as to reasonableness, would be correspondingly diminished. And we've cited cases in our brief that hold to that effect. And with that, my time has expired. If the court has any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Just a second, ask one question.
Of course.
Counsel, this will be for Mr. Gunther as well. The Nevada Supreme Court, I believe, recently filed a case called Placer Dome versus the provincial government of Marin Duque. I'm just wondering if you've looked at that, if you think that case has any play in the facts and all of this case here.
Regrettably, Your Honor, I'm not familiar with the facts of that case.
Very well. It's very recent, so don't feel bad. It may not have any play, but I thought of that as you were going through these various arguments here as well.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Gunther.
Your Honors, they say no minimum contacts for Evan and Hoekstrada, but this is from the Burger King U.S. Supreme Court opinion. So long as a commercial actor's efforts are purposefully directed toward residents of another state, we have consistently rejected the notion that an absence of physical contacts can defeat personal jurisdiction. Eben and Hoekstrada were at the hub of this conspiracy, from Europe directing the officers and the directors and conspiring with the officers and directors, actually directing to get the officers and directors of Asia Rim Corporation changed so that they could carry on they were pledged to 100% of the stock. They could have presumably foreclosed on it, but instead they went through this other route to basically take it away. We have purposeful direction of actions into Nevada by Eben and Hoekstrada through Hovers and Van Offs, if nothing else. Chief, SEC filing office is a contact that was implemented by Eben and Hoekstrada at the same time they were insisting that in order to do this $28 million sham deal that Evan was funding with Asia Rim, that they had to change officers or directors, they had to change the principal office to Nevada. There's something more than just satisfying the first two elements.
Tell us, Mr. Gunther, let's say we agreed with you and we sent this back for an evidentiary hearing. What would you be prepared to show at that evidentiary hearing? They're saying everything, they're disputing these facts here. Everything happened in Europe, and obviously there's a dispute over how you phrase it. What kind of proof do you have on this?
I would need to actually conduct some jurisdictional discovery, probably deposition of the defendants, frankly. Because
is this speculation, or do you have some concrete proof here at this stage to dig into these issues with this discovery?
Oh, I have some concrete. Mr. Eben had testified in the New York action about funding the URAM people before anyone knew that anything about his connection to the URAM deal. And since the URAM deal was where the insistence was to change officers and directors and change the SEC filing point from Hong Kong to Reno, and then, he says he made a deal with Hovers in a written communication to go through with the transaction even after authority had been revoked by the shareholders who changed and removed and deposed Hovers. In some courts, in this conspiracy theory of personal jurisdiction that imputes contacts from one co-conspirator to another, there's various theories, agency or some heightened pleading that's required in some jurisdictions. We pled what we could at the time, and then we supplemented with affidavits when we got into the motion practice, but we didn't have an opportunity to conduct any discovery to flesh out. There was some. Van Oss was at CES in Las Vegas a month before the URAM deal was presented to the Asia Rim folks. So we're not entirely sure.
So you basically have some circumstantial evidence right now.
There's some circumstantial evidence that we would like to flesh out if we're going to have to do that at an evidentiary hearing on jurisdiction ahead of time or at the end after we've conducted discovery in the case, which would include that jurisdictional discovery. But either way, we think we've got the purposeful direction from both sets of defendants into Nevada. One, you have officers and directors breaching fiduciary duties. The other's aiding and abetting. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Gunther. Thank you. I forgot we have...
Momentarily, Your Honor. I misspoke and used the phrase personal interjection when describing one of the Ninth Circuit factors that it uses. I meant purposeful interjection. I just wanted to correct that for the court and avoid confusion.
Thank you very much. With that representation, this case will stand submitted.